Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Time for another old show that I'm representing for a couple reasons. One, as I continue to get the new stuff ready, I wanted to let you guys, especially during the holidays, a lot of people are traveling, give you a lot more content than we normally do. So these are episodes that happened very early in Word Balloon's history, before the September 2006 RSS feed. So that was a good 15 months of Word Balloon episodes that did not make it to the new feed, and I've slowly been putting them back. This is a great episode from very early in 2006 with Jimmy Palmiotti. We talk about some interesting books of the past and books that Jimmy is still working on. Case in point, Jonah Hex. This was very early in Jonah Hex's run, and you hear a lot about the formation of the revamped series and some plans that ended up coming to fruition later in the run. You'll hear about them in its infancy. Plus, Jimmy talks a lot about his work with Justin Gray on books like Hawkman, Resistance, and 21 Down. We also talk about his work with Amanda Connor on the JSA Classified miniseries featuring Power Girl that was written by Jeff Johns and planted the seeds for the current Power Girl series. So I think you'll enjoy it. A lot of neat stuff. We start off, believe it or not, with something that Jimmy and Justin did at Marvel, a miniseries featuring the Daughters of the Dragon.
Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation site. This is John Suntress. Jimmy Palmiotti is well known to comic readers for his art and his run as co-editor of the Marvel Knights line with current Marvel editor-in-chief Joe Quesada. But he's also stretched his writer muscles to good success on some memorable and current books. At their company, Event Comics, he and Quesada co-created Painkiller Jane, which was just adapted for a film that premiered this season on the Sci-Fi Channel. He and his fiancée, Amanda Connor, and their friend, Garth Ennis, created The Pro, the highly controversial satire about a super prostitute that equally delighted and disturbed some comic fans. Currently, Jimmy's chief writing partner is Justin Gray. Our conversation begins with Jimmy's rundown on all of his current writing projects.
Justin and I are doing, Jonah Hex for DC and Bloodhaven, the Crisis Aftermath book. Again, that's a miniseries. And we have an ongoing series and a miniseries we're also doing that I can't say what it is yet. One of them is with Amanda Connor, though. At Marvel, we have Daughters of the Dragon, but I mean, you know, it's weird to say because you write six issues of a miniseries and the books come out, you know, 8 months later. So it probably looks like I have 1,000 books coming out. And then if you look at the inking stuff, then it's another three or four books easy. But a lot of this stuff is done way in advance. I have two series at each company that are coming out in the next 6 months that are already all done. So, you know, so it's very deceiving, but I do put in a full day of work. And again, with Justin and I writing, it's sort of like two people's workload.
And how did you team up with Justin in terms of writing?
Justin was an intern when Joe Quesada and I were doing Marvel Knights. When we started up there, and he came up, and we became friends, and when I left Marvel Knights, we stayed friends. And Justin was this brilliant guy that kept pitching me pretty much every day. He had another idea for something, and I told him, you know, if the direction, if anything ever changes, we should work together on something. And we stayed friends, and the opportunity actually came when Wildstorm approached us to pitch them a couple of new series. And I figured, well, this might be a nice time to sit with Justin and work out something, and we did 21 Down and the Resistance together.
Okay.
And we've been working ever since. I mean, we both have our own projects we do. I have, you know, the stuff I do, like New West, and I just did a bunch of romance stories for Marvel, and he's got stuff coming up at DC and Marvel, so we both have our own group of books. But together, we actually have a lot more, it's a lot more fun working with him, because we both kind of get together, make a day of it, and then use the computers most of the other time. Pretty much like Stephen King and Peter Straub did when they collaborate.
Would you say that it's been 50-50 in terms of your ideas for these stories?
For ideas, 50-50, I'd say completion of the finished scripts, I'd say more like 60-40, where he would be doing more of the legwork. I'm a better salesman and an idea guy, and his strengths are definitely taking what we did and putting it on paper, and then we both pick it to death. You know, we literally bounce scripts back and forth like six or seven times until we're happy.
Okay.
You know, so dialogue gets reworked, and, you know, we even go so far as to read it out loud and see how stupid it sounds. You know, and eventually everything's got a beat to it. We always look at it like music. You know, it's got to have a certain beat, and each genre has obviously its own soundtrack.
It seems like you guys enjoy working a lot in kind of the espionage vein when you think of things like 21 Down and even Daughters of the Dragon, even though it's
you know, straight-up adventure. It just kind of has that kind of vibe of secret agents. And
well, you know, I tell you, you know, you tend to write what you like. And to me, you know, the superhero stuff, and most of them, are pretty much the basic same thing over and over. And it, you know, when you grow up reading this stuff, eventually you kind of get sick of it a little bit. And that's when, like, genre stuff gets more interesting. 21 Down was our take on X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Resistance was our, which was a complete failure, was our take on politics. We had so many political things going on in that book. You know, it was our way of saying, you know, politics can be fun, but obviously not too much fun. Because nobody bought it. But,
and,
you know, things like the Monolith are just, with Monolith, we were trying to create an iconic character, something that had history, you know, and so on and so forth. And we do both love the genre stuff. And again, even, you know, I always compare comics to film because how can you not?
Sure.
And I am the guy that hunts down the, Justin and I both are the guys that hunt down the little art films that want to see the things we haven't seen before. You know, blockbusters are great, but really they're aiming for a certain happy zone in your brain, and we rather go with the thinking zone. And that's why, so we wind up with a lot of odd books, and like Daughters of the Dragon is a good example of characters that nobody wanted to do. And we figured, well, Marvel's not going to give us any of their main books, because they have like six or seven guys, you know, Bendis, Brubaker, whatever. They get everything. Okay, and that's all there is to it. They have contract guys. They're the superstars. Daughters of the Dragon, you know, no, we had to pitch stuff that nobody wanted to do. And unfortunately, you know, the way the process works is that the guys like Straczynski, Brubaker, or Bendis say, I want to do this character maybe a year from now, or I want to do another character 2 years from now. So we can't even touch those. So we kind of had to dig deep, and something I enjoyed when I was younger was, you know, Misty Knight and Colleen Wing. Of course, who wouldn't like two girls going around doing karate and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we pitched all these bizarro characters, and that one stuck, and then we found the artist. But, you know, it's a matter of luck of the draw. When you're pitching, you know, until they start chasing us down or consider Justin and I somebody to go after, we have to pitch, which isn't the case with DC's a little better educated, where we pretty much they come with us with the project. Yeah.
So in the case of Daughters of the Dragon, that was something you pitched to Marvel.
Yeah, we pitched to Marvel, and then we pitched it with an artist, Carrie Evans, that pretty much I saw his work in the Wizard World LA. He came up, showed me some samples, and we talked, and I liked his stuff, and he said he wasn't really getting much attention for the samples he's showing, and I couldn't understand why. So I had him do some samples for the Daughters book, and I pitched it with his sketches, and he definitely helped us get the gig as well.
Well, it looks great. I really enjoyed the first issue, and I think it started off with a lot of action, and you set up the characters in a good way as well. I mean, they look fantastic. You suddenly hit the ground running, understanding, you know, who these characters are in relation to the stories.
Yeah, that was our Jerry Bruckheimer comic.
Yeah, sure.
We wanted to open it with a bang and then get you just right in the middle of their chaotic world. And we figured for characters that nobody really cares about, you have to work extra hard to get people to care about them. That's why we have the girls fussing at each other. because right away we kind of get where they're at and, you know, that they like each other, but they're in the middle of chaos. And again, in 22 pages, you're either going to get hook the reader, or you're going to lose them. So that's all we have. We have that little movie trailer. Either you're going to want to see the movie or you're not. So we had to put as much as we can into it. And the funny thing is, you know, it's different than most of the first issues we do because it's really not a lot to read, but a lot is going on, you know. So we tried something a little different with it, and I'm glad you enjoyed it. I mean, it got ordered, you know, mediocre.
Really?
Yeah, it got ordered kind of low. The good thing is most of the retailers sold out of it. So I'm hoping it picks up a little bit because, boy, I would love to do another miniseries with the whole team. With the characters. You know, it's something like this. A lot of the Marvel books, if they don't have anything to do with a big crossover, or they're not the main characters, have to get their own momentum. And we have six issues to do it. So they'll know by issue 4 or 5 whether it's worth pursuing another mini.
I was always a Deadly Hands of Kung Fu fan. The black and white Marvel magazine that would have Daughters of the Dragon stories in it.
Yeah, the Marshall Rogers stuff in it.
And it was great to see, hopefully to support your series, that they reprinted a bunch of those old stories as well.
Oh, yeah. No, we as you and I both know, they censored some of that.
Yes, they did.
but still, you know, credit is do for them actually putting it together, and really nice that they put a little teaser in the back of some of our pages, you know. The only negative thing that happened from that is a lot of retailers ordered that and didn't order the book.
I see.
And they thought, oh, no, we ordered that. And then when it came in, they didn't have it.
That's too bad, because, yeah, I got both, and it was nice to see them in the original form, and, yeah, I enjoy the update as well. Is it possible that, without giving anything away with the initial miniseries, will we see the other heroes for hire in the story?
I'll give you this much. Iron Fist comes in at the end. I could be wrong, but I think it's the end of issue 3.
Okay.
And he's in the rest of the series. It's either the end of issue 3 or 4. He's right on the cover, I think, of 4 or 5. But the girls also visit, later on in the book, the Mole Man.
Okay.
Which is, I think, one of the funniest scenes ever. And at one point, they have to... they need some more weapons. So they have some... They actually meet up with a Marvel character and kind of pillage his warehouse. And, of course, if you figure out who would have guns in New York, it would be the Punisher. We have a lot of funny things like that, and we have more villains coming in, and, you know, it's sort of like, because they're bounty hunters, they're getting all these low-end villains that are running around in the book, and you know, like I said, I'm glad you enjoyed it. One review I read, you know, so everybody sends me the reviews, and it's fun to read them. One person was just like, you know, it's blatant TNA, and it's this and that, and I'm just like, oh, calm down. The guy draws beautiful women.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing. These girls are tough, and they're in control of the book. You know, this is all feminism, full-blown, you know. Just
sure.
Because they're running around and their tops are coming off, that doesn't make them bad.
Well, know? there's that Switchblade Sisters, to put it in art movie kind
Absolutely.
Of terms. Although not art, really, but, you know, cult movie terms.
Yeah, I mean, I, like I said, I think it's fun. I hope it picks up a little bit, the sales on it. Like I said, we'd love another chance to do something. We put Iron Fist in it because we wanted to, but I'm hoping even that, you know, maybe it gets ordered a little higher towards the end, and that saves the series.
Sure, sure. Yeah,
so we get our fingers crossed.
And it's a natural connection, too. Obviously, Colleen Wing, Misty Knight, too. Both of them were very predominant in Iron Fist.
Yes, there is some moments in the series where Misty has some, moments with Danny, and there is some major Iron Fist moments as well. You know, we kind of like, we're really having fun with the characters. We're trying to look at them as if this was a film. How would they be represented? You know, because if you do the comic, if you go completely the comic route, then you're going to get wrapped up in the samurai and the bionic arm.
Yeah.
You know, and although that's interesting, it's not who they are. And that's what we tried to do with the book, is they have these things going for them, but that's not who they are. And we actually, the second issue introduces, they have an indestructible male secretary that takes a job in their office. That is a lot of fun as well.
So, that's cool.
Yeah, there's fun stuff coming.
Well, let's go to the other side of the other big publisher, and that's DC with Jonah Hex. Great start. I've enjoyed all three issues. I appreciate the fact that they're all one-shot issues as well.
Yeah.
And it really does, you know, call back to the old 70s Jonah Hex stories as well, where, hell, they were doing it in 11 pages. You guys get 22, but you put a lot in those 22 pages.
Yeah, well, you know, we modeled it after the old stuff. I used to watch a lot of Gunsmoke.
Me too.
With my mom. And in 1 hour, we got a lot of stuff. A lot of character stuff, a lot of story, a lot of backstory. People introduced. It was funny. It was exciting. It was dramatic. And what a well-done show. And there's no reason why you can't do a Western comic and not nail the whole story in one issue. The guys did it before us for how many issues? Almost 100 issues. And we just felt that let's try this until they tell us not to. And Luke Ross is on the first. He's on the first bunch, so he's on the first six. Although Tony DeZunga is doing issue 5.
I heard about that. I think that's terrific.
Yeah, Tony. I met Tony at WonderCon. I went out to him and called him a god and, you know, paid homage to him and bought a nice pinup of Jonah Hex home, and then asked him for his phone number and asked if he'd ever be interested in drawing some. And he drew a whole issue, and we're hoping to get him on another one, but it's beautiful stuff. But Luke, Luke's doing a brilliant job, and we just thought, let's see if this works. You know, if it doesn't work, we can do 2- and 3-parters down the line, if people are asking for it. But so far, so good, because now we're 3 issues in, you know, we managed to get one character. You know, we wanted to put Batlash in there.
Yep.
And have a little fun with anybody who read in the past. But again, if you never read it, you can get it.
Sure.
Yeah, and we figured, like I said, you know, 22 pages seems like a lot, I'll tell you the truth, $2.99 for a comic is a lot for me. So, you know, I think a nice, satisfying read per book is the way to go. And I don't think that everything has to continue. Let's be honest, these are days in the man's life. We're having a ball on that. I mean, we have already, I think we have like 10 issues done already.
Oh, that's terrific.
And, you know, they're going to base it on sales, how long we can go. So the first two issues they just announced sold out, so that's good.
Congratulations, yes.
Thank you. And, you know, we're hoping that it picks up a little bit, you know. We're hoping that people, it's the book that people buy just because they want to read something. You know, and again, it's not part of DC's crossovers. I mean, if I had, you know, if I had any kind of character, if I threw Green Lantern in there, it would sell like double.
Well, sure.
You know, but we have to exist on our own, you know, and although I do, we are playful with some things in the book. People who know comics, when they read them, especially in the middle issues, like 6, 7, and 8, there's some crazy stuff in it that kind of is a wink to people who read comics. But, you know, to us, it's like another genre book that we think, you know, there's a need for, and, you know, it's doing pretty good, so I guess people want it, you know.
I think it does stack up really nicely compared to the old stuff from the 70s, much like the Daughters of the Dragon. I mean, I'm a fan of that as well, but I really think that Luke has a good style that compares well to Tony's. And again, yay, I think you guys are catching that right pacing the same way that John Albino did on the original run as well.
Yeah, the original books, I still have them all. I have every single one of them. Even those terrible textbooks. Where he goes in the future.
You know, I liked that Keith Giffen series. I appreciated the weirdness of it.
Yeah, you know what? It was my... Mark Texera, who I went to high school with, was drawing those books.
Okay.
And we used to laugh because it was Tex doing Hex, you know? And, yeah, they were fun, but, you know, it could have been its own title, you know?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
But, yeah, the showcase book is awesome. I mean, my thing is, where's the second one?
Here.
You know, and it had to do well. I can't imagine it didn't sell. I have no idea what it sold, but I can't imagine it didn't do really well. But those, you know, read those. You read those stories. Our stories are, you know, it's just like that. We kind of just, you know, why change a good thing? I think it worked back then. You know, we're a little meaner. I gotta say, our Hex is just a little meaner in parts, but he still has, you know, the morals. It's still, you know, God is still ignoring him, but he's still doing the right thing in his own bizarre way. And he's a really interesting character to write. I mean, I'm hoping that Warner Brothers, which owns it, gets off their ass and says, you know what, how great would it be to do a Jonah Hex TV show every week?
No kidding.
With single stories, just...
You know, that Gunsmoke format, exactly.
Exactly, and just take these damn books we're writing and just use it as a blueprint. Because we're really, it's not a big budget thing.
That's true.
You know, it's just all character stuff. And you know, I think that would work great.
That's really cool. Are there plans? Because one of the interesting things about Jonah Hex is you never really know how his face got fucked up. I mean, you really don't. And it's...
Are we allowed to say fuck?
You can say anything you want. It's the internet, man.
Oh, okay, good.
See, that's why, I mean, we'll get to the pro and stuff like that, absolutely. Okay. No, it's, gloves are off, man, say whatever you want.
Okay, all right, I've been holding back.
Well, you're a good man, but no, feel free.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing about Hex is that he is such a man of mystery. You know, he was a Confederate, you know a little bit about him, you can tell in terms of his demeanor, his character, but there are a lot of questions about Jonah Hex.
Well, we are going to open up a little bit of the mystery. Okay. We are tackling it, okay. Probably we're doing a three-part story in the future.
Okay.
And I'm not talking in the future you know, Hex 2099. I'm talking about, you know, later on in the series.
Sure.
Maybe 12 or 13, whatever. And we're having a very famous European artist is drawing it right now. And we wrote it specifically for him. And we're pretty much covering Hex coming off the Civil War, right after the Civil War, and pretty much how he became a bounty hunter and how his face got messed up and a little bit about his dad.
Okay.
And we just felt that if we get a chance to work with this person, I can't say who it is, that we have to kind of step up to the plate and give him something that we've never seen before. So we're excited about that, but it's still, you know, I don't think it's going to ruin it for anybody. It's just our take on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be interesting because, Probably over here, nobody could care less about his artwork. But overseas, he's one of the top five guys.
That's cool.
Yeah, but, and he's brilliant. He handed in the first issue, and I was like, I wet myself. I was so happy.
You know, I really liked, speaking of European Westerns, Joe Kubert's work on that Italian comic Tex.
The textbook, yeah. You know, I got that from Joe.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's stunning, and it's big and fat and long and wonderfully drawn, and oh, my God. I mean, I think they put it in English, right?
They
put it
in English. Yes, they did.
I mean, that book needs to be pushed on people.
No kidding.
Because, boy, oh, boy, I never see it anywhere. It's stunning, but you know, like Sergeant Rock that came out last week, mm-hmm. The guy can do no wrong.
Oh, he's a genius. He's a master.
He really is. I mean, he's a guy. It's my God, his age, knocking out stuff that just it looks amazing. It's embarrassing. All the little whiners that are whining about their job need to be smacked by Joe. They need to go and kick their ass all over the highway.
Who are some of the guys, the legends that are still out there that you look forward to and that you've really sat down and talked shop with in terms of page design or you know, tried to figure things out with?
Well, I think one of the smarter guys in the business, smartest, is Howard Chaykin.
Certainly.
Because Howard just... He's such a pleasure to talk to. He's such a smart guy. He's well-versed. He knows everything about everything. And even when he doesn't know about it, he fakes it really well. And he's a great guy. You know, I mean, I've hung out and worked with guys like Bernie Wrightson, who I love, just a sweetheart. Len Wein and Marv Wolfman. I have a lot of respect for people that came before, so I try to... be as humble around them as I can and try to learn from these guys. You know, like guys like Stranko, Paul Galassi, one of my best friends in the industry. Paul is just brilliant and one of the funniest guys ever. And, you know, one of my closest friends, Garth Ennis. I mean, Garth is just, we're best friends. And he's another guy that his work is stunning. I think, every time he's reinventing the wheel, he's just crazy.
That's very cool. Chaykin has taken over Hawkman from you guys.
Yes, he is. And him and Walt.
Yeah, Walter Simonson.
Again, two of the nicest guys in the world. If they got to take your book away, those are the guys you want to do it. But realistically, you know, we had a nice run on Hawkman, and, you know, in the perfect world, we would have left at 46,
mm-hmm.
issue 46, but they had that crossover going, so we did the last three issues, and it was a great setup. For Howard and Walt's book, it has nothing to do with what we were doing, and more power to them. I think it's going to do really well, and I can't wait to see that. That's a book, like, I'm dying to see, you know?
Is the fate of Hawkman explained in things like 52 and things like that?
Yeah.
Okay, because
yeah,
I know, obviously, it's been announced that it's Hawkgirl.
Yeah, the title of the book's Hawkgirl. In 52, Hawkgirl and Hawkman are kind of completely covered. We left them... fucking like rabbits. In the last two issues, especially the last one that's out, I mean, they're just getting hardcore with each other. Because we figured, well, you know what? We're leaving the book. We might as well. Everybody wanted that on their mind. And we've hinted at it. I always said it's like a moonlighting book. Where are they or aren't they?
Yes.
But the joke is that, you know, they're both adults and they need to get laid. And, when we first took over the series from Jeff Johns, the first thing we said is, you know, this guy needs to get laid. We read Jeff's run, and he's never nailed Hawkgirl. So the first four issues we did were that, well, he lives in St. Roch, which is New Orleans.
Right.
So we had him go to a jazz bar and pick up a girl and nail her at the museum. I mean, he's a guy that runs a museum that's rich and handsome. Why not? So he nailed the jazz singer.
Well, and he's got that kind of Conan-like warrior background as well. So, yeah, I think after a while you got to grab a wench or whatever.
Chicks love that. He probably grabs the back of their hair and pulls on it a little bit. You know, he's that kind of guy. And chicks love that. And the hairy chest, you know, Hawkman's got the hairy chest.
Yes.
Which, you know, he's got that Connery thing going on.
Certainly. Yeah, that's a good... Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, and he's got that, I'm dangerous, you know, and there is no woman on earth that does not like a dangerous man.
Well, and I also liked the Golden Eagle story that you guys wove in at the end as well, you know, kind of tying his background into Hawkman's and really explaining the character. And I like the fact that you even kind of took it to the edge with his wanting to claim everything of Hawkman's, including Hawkgirl.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're going to you're going to buy the boat, you should get the oars with it, you know. And he Golden Eagle, you know, Golden Eagle was our, we were doing the book, and Justin and I were both like, we need something to get people to read this, damn it. And we started looking through the history of Hawkman and Teen Titans and all this kind of stuff, and we saw the Golden Eagle idea sitting there, but we had to weave this basket together, and boy, it wasn't easy, you know, because when you take over a book, like, especially a guy like Jeff Johns, who just, he's great, he's got his audience, they don't want to hear from us, so we have to come, you know, we have to bring something to the table that they're not expecting, you know, we brought Golden Eagle storyline in, and we just figured, all right, this sort of shake up everybody a little bit. And then, you know, having it was funny because Hawkman, we have him die.
Yes.
You know, you see him die. And when we got the art came in, I asked Steve Wacker, I'm like, is there any way we can have an arm ripped off and maybe his heart removed? You know, if they can touch up the art. And they did. They sent it back and got the art touched up. Because I said, because I read comics, and I know unless I see an arm missing and a heart out, that guy's still alive.
No, you're right, and it's funny. It was that hole in his chest that had us all saying, "All right, well, he must be dead."
Yep, and that was you know, me being the fanboy saying, "No, nobody's dead. I saw Jason. I know Jason. You can cut, you know, unless you cut his head off and it's somewhere else, he's still alive." You know, and that's how I felt with Hawkman. And you know, we shook up the fans. The book got picked up and sold out, and you know, that's what we're supposed to do. You know. We're the new carnival in town. We got to show you the new freak show, you know. We have the new guys in the freak show. And like I said, it was a nice run. It's probably our longest run on anything. And again, a mainstream book. So we had a shot at doing that. And at the same time, we were doing Monolith, which was going the other way.
Yeah.
You know, although I'm infinitely more proud of the Monolith book than I am Hawkman. But that said, Monolith is a lot more personal vision, you know.
Well, and I think it's tough creating new characters in this environment and letting them sustain and getting the opportunity to build an audience. It's like TV. I don't think you guys, there's the time to really to do it.
Yeah, well, I you know what, with Monolith, I kind of begged all the other writers at the time to use the character, to put it in their books.
Sure.
And they yesed me to death and nobody did it.
Okay.
And, you know, when you don't have that kind of cooperation, then it becomes its own pocket universe.
Yes.
And that was a big mistake, because we should have had the character in other books, and the deal, Dan, you know, really planned to get that going. But, you know, the good thing is we get a chance later on to put him somewhere else, and he's actually showing up in another book.
Oh, I was wondering that. Okay.
Yeah, and with the two girls as well, because the Tilt and Hallis, or, you know, it's funny, when you work on a characters for so long, you feel like you know these people, and when you don't do them, you feel like you just murdered them. And I know it sounds ridiculous, but it really is that way. With 21 down, I just felt like I cheated somebody's life when I stopped when we got the new series killed, because we already had an issue drawn and written and everything.
Wow.
You know, with Monolith, I felt like, you know, we knew the 12 was the last issue, so we wrapped up the story, we bookended it. But realistically, you know, in our heads, we have like 100 other adventures with them.
Wow.
You know, but again, it's like anything. You know, if the audience connects, great. If they don't, well, there's that thing, you know.
I got you.
We think maybe, you know, as we become more popular or people start to buy our stuff, then we can apply the characters better. Because we've been underdogs for so long.
Sure.
You know?
Well, but luckily, I think you guys have responded by coming up with, you know, interesting concepts and genres. And I think one thing I wanted to talk about was your Black Bolt stuff with Phil Noto. I really enjoyed Beautiful Dreamer a lot, and that hit a lot of familiar tones, but also New West as well.
Yeah, it was Beautiful Killer, but I like Beautiful Dreamer too. That's my next one, I think. Stealing that name, I like it.
That was one of the New Gods, Beautiful Dreamer. Shame on
Dreamer, that's right.
Okay, sure. Beautiful Killer. Excuse me.
The books I do with Phil, I tell you, I'm working on another one with Phil called Trigger Girl.
Oh, I saw that on your website. Yes.
Yeah, we have a little teaser piece on it. I don't have a publisher yet, but that's not really a big problem. It's that we want to keep 100% of the rights.
Sure.
So that's why we don't have a publisher yet. But you know, at the end of the day, we'll find somebody. But those are my books. Those are my film frustration books.
Okay.
You know, this is like the movies I want to make. Beautiful Killer, New West. There's a couple of things I have. Trigger Girl is another one. And Phil gets it. Like, Phil and I, we both get it. You know, whether you like Phil's art or not, he's got his own look. And I'm always I'll do anything with him because he's so terrific.
Personally, I love Phil's art because it has that great 60s and 70s, that great era of paperbacks.
Yes.
Look to it and everything. And when he was doing those Birds of Prey covers, for example, it really classed up the books. I mean, they just really had this great distinct thing. And like you say, yes, he draws beautiful women.
Oh, yeah, he draws beautiful women. And you know what? He's a great storyteller. And I got to tell you, like, you know, it's such a pleasure to open up the JPEGs he sends me of each new page.
I bet.
It really makes my day. Plus, we've had some good luck with both properties because... Well, Beautiful Killer was picked up for development at Universal with Jessica Alba, and New West is right now has a life of its own with a couple of studios. It's bouncing around, but I think, you know, it wouldn't work without Phil's work. You know, it wouldn't work. The books, if drawn by somebody else, I don't think they would have been as good.
No, I got you. Well, and he even subtly can make these characters look like, you know, a bit like famous actors. Certainly in Beautiful Killer. You know, the parents definitely had that Honor Blackman and kind of Connery look, but then again, not.
Yeah, I do that to him. I go, because in New West, I said, it's Bruce Willis, but it's older guy, but he's older, but he's got that kind of, you know, last Boy Scout kind of tiredness to him. You know, and the girls, he has this kind of girl he draws. You know, so the best I can do is say, make her a blonde. You know, and he does his own thing. But their little films, New West was a real challenge for me because, man, I didn't think anyone would buy that.
I did.
Because, really, well, I appreciate that. But, you know, you look at it, and it's just a guy on a horse with a sword.
With a samurai sword, yeah.
You know, and we actually, you know, we were coming back from ChicagoCon, and I asked Bill at the airport, I'm like, on the next book, what do you want to draw? And he said to me, I don't know, if you could write something with a guy, like a horse and a sword, if you can come up with a story like that. And he goes, but I kind of like crime, and if it's Los Angeles would be cool. And I'm like, so I got the little, you know, the ingredients. And I was like, And I was reading about pulse weapons, and you know, I came up with the idea, and I told Phil, you know what, to do this justice, we need to go to L.A. for a week. So we hopped on a plane. We went to L.A., saw a friend of ours' movie premiere. A friend of ours did this, David Mendel did this movie, Euro Trip.
Okay, yeah.
And we made a week out of it looking at locations. I mean, it's so corny, but hey, you know, the tax man loves it. We deducted it.
Yeah, beautiful.
And we came back and, you know, got to work on New West. And you know, the challenge for me was, can I finish this whole story in two issues? Can I create this whole history of all these people together? Because it really was just about a big, bulky backstory about how this guy just is so interacting with everyone in this one family,
mm-hmm.
where he really shouldn't be. And, you know, pulse weapon idea came for me, came out of just reading an article that the Army was working on a weapon that would kill the, you know, sort of like before an atomic bomb went off, all electric would die.
Yes.
And they were trying to find a current that can sustain that. And, you know, in the book, in a way, it was inspired by Chinatown as well. You know, there's so many things going on in that book. But at the end of the day, it's still a guy on a horseback with a sword chopping people up. And we all love that.
And it had that a Ross McDonald kind of, you know, Lou Archer kind of feel to it as well.
Yeah, yeah. There was, well, you know, everybody was tired and everybody was, you know, they've seen it all.
Yes.
And they've seen it with each other and other people. And, you know, I tell you the truth, I wrote it, I finished it, and I looked back on it, and I said, I don't know who it possessed me. Sure, I didn't know I had it in me to tell that story. And I got to tell you, it was one of those weird things where it was kind of writing itself. And it's probably the nicest part of doing this job is when that happens, when all of a sudden it's just making sense. I mean, I was making stuff up and laughing out loud, and my meter for everything is Amanda, you know, Amanda Connor,
yes.
She's my fiance, and I run into the other room, I'm like, is this the stupidest thing you ever heard, or the funniest thing, you know, and there's a line in it that the girl standing in front of him as he's laying on the couch, Dan, in front of Dan Wise, and he's in his head, he's going, that girl's pants are so tight I can read her lips. Now, it's the oldest line in the book,
sure,
for when I was a kid, you know, and I'm like, I'm putting it in the book. I know everyone's heard it a million times before, but it kind of works, you know, and it's stuff like that that you kind of just giggle and say, oh my God, you know, Black Bull at the time just told me that no nudity, no cursing, no anything, so I did everything I could not to have any of that. Yet everyone's girls are going around in bikinis and they're topless, but not showing anything.
That's right.
And people are cursing, but I made up words. I made up like 30 words in those two books that mean nothing. That mean there's a word, zabid. I use it like a term less than zero. Amanda made it up in a dream, you know. But you throw the words in, and if they just have the right beat, like music, if it's just in the middle of the tune, it has the right beat, then it works.
Sure.
Because the reader fills it in. I think saying fuck and piss and shit is all great, you know. Like the freedom that Azzarello has with Loveless is great.
Certainly.
He can curse like a sail. I can't do that with Hex, but what I can do is I can pour a bucket of blood on a guy and let dogs eat the guy. You know?
Yeah, it's not a bad second place.
Right, and you know what I mean? So, it, you know, there's things the way around it, but I'm glad you like that book.
You know, now, and you mentioned your work with Amanda and sexuality in comics. The pro has to come to mind, because much like that joke that you put in New West, you either were, you know, on board and got the joke, or it seemed like there was a whole group of people incredibly offended by this project.
Yeah, how can you get offended? Amanda's drawings are so cute. How can you really get offended by that book? I mean, really, you know, and you know, in Spain, in I think it was in Madrid, they had a convention, and it was the premiere of the pro in Spanish, in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
It was a hardcover, and what they did is they blew up the blowjob scene, life-size, and put a little step-up thing, and you could put your head where Superman's face was, and they were taking pictures, okay? And kids were getting in line, getting with the parents taking a picture of, like, them as Superman getting a blowjob from the pro. You gotta love that.
You bet.
Imagine that was in San Diego. I would be arrested in 5 minutes, you know? But the pro was a book that, you know, we got free publicity because Jim Steranko, it was right after 9/11, and he announced that the idea of the pro, the book, that me, Amanda, and Garth were just as bad as the 9/11 terrorists.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jim, who lives up in the mountains of God knows where, Pennsylvania or whatever, I mean, we were in New York for 9/11, and I saw that, and people were sending it to me, and I got a call from the newspapers, you know, the Daily News.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to reply to what Jim said? And I said, absolutely not. I said, if I reply, then it's printed again.
Right.
And I called up Jim, and I confronted Jim on it, and we talked about it, and Jim said, no, it was a misunderstanding. That's not the case at all, because I knew Jim, and I was like, what the hell is he talking about, you know?
Yeah, that's a guy that in Nick Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. obviously had a lot of sexuality in there.
Yeah, and let's be honest, this was fun.
Yes.
It was not really offensive, but the thing was, he never saw the book. He didn't see the book yet. He just based it on the fact that in an interview I said it's a lot of evil fun. And he started going in, there's enough evil in the world, these guys are just as bad as terror. You know, he went in on this thing, and he misquoted and misread, and we talked it out. And the only thing I did, I had papers, news sites, everything asking me to reply to it, because they knew it was insane what he was saying.
Sure.
And I said, you know what? I respect the guy, so I'm not going to drag him down. It's too easy a target. But what I did do is use his quotes in all the ads. And at the end, we dedicated to it the book to him. So it's the extra joke at the end. You read the whole book, and then the last page it says dedicated to Jim Steranko, and either you get it. Or you don't.
I'm with you.
And Jim got it.
That's cool.
You know, and
he's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a pisser. I love him. You know, he just was emotional about the whole thing. And yeah, look, whatever. My attitude in life is you're going to make mistakes. You're going to be an asshole and not forgive people. Then you better look in the mirror. You know.
Right.
And expect the same. And I'm people can do stupid things. I have a hard time forgiving mean things. People do stupid things. People make mistakes. But when people are mean, I don't really like it too much.
I can appreciate that.
Because it actually takes thought to go and be mean to somebody, you know, and there's no empathy in that kind of thing. So usually, you know, people who do that have their own problems. But so that worked out. But, we, you know, we love doing that book, you know.
So is the American market, is it getting better in terms of accepting?
No.
I'm glad you said no, because
no.
It's so weird. I mean, Marvel... Right when you guys were still doing Marvel Knights and stuff, put their foot forward and say, hey, we're doing the Max line.
Yeah.
And look, and watch out. And really, the Punisher is really the only Max book that's still going. And even that really is more about violence than it is sexuality.
I am all for sex in comics. I want people fucking on the cover. I want to break panel borders with cum shots. You know what I'm saying? No, but seriously, though, I don't... I have a European mentality. Now, I'm a guy from Brooklyn my whole life. I have a European mentality. Sex is fun. It's healthy. Sex in comics is cool. Nothing was cooler when I was a kid than seeing Daughters of the Dragon with a top coming off.
You bet.
Seeing Howard the Duck in bed with Bev.
Yeah.
Let's see. I can name, like, the things. Conan, Red Nails. Oh, my God. You know, whenever we got a little peek or a tease, it was that more titillating.
Sure.
Okay? And now we're mature, so now the books are aimed towards adults. I mean, I remember the comics Tits and Clits, all this kind of underground comics. They don't even exist anymore. And, you know, my whole thing is if we were in Europe, this wouldn't be a conversation, okay? But the violence would be, okay? Now, I think we're too easy with violence. And it's funny because I saw the movie Hostel last week.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that?
No, I want to. I know about it, certainly.
Okay, it's wonderful. All right? It's got TNA. It's about three guys in Amsterdam. There's TNA. There's violence. I did close my eyes for one scene. I have to admit, I couldn't watch it. It's so unbelievably violent that I was kind of laughing because it's insane.
Sure.
But you know it's a film. You're sitting there and you know it's a film. It's not a documentary.
Right, okay? And I know what you're getting into, exactly.
Absolutely. You know, what's probably more startling to me was like Munich. You know, Munich, a wonderful film, but the violence was so realistic in it.
Yeah, I agree, and I did see that, and I thought it was incredible.
A wonderful film, and, you know.
But as hardcore as, and more hardcore than The Godfather. I mean, really, this was the violence of Private Ryan in a vengeance movie.
Oh, the scene with the pipe bullets thing,
yep.
I don't want to give away to anybody.
Yep.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
Where they just take those pipes and, you know, they use those things for, like, construction, too. It's like a bullet in the back of a thing to push a nail forward.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible. Wonderful. Insane. Realistic. You know, you walked out of that theater. I couldn't shake Munich for weeks.
Yeah, I was blown away, too.
And again, the political message is, you know, what does it mean? And then I see Hostel, and I'm thinking, it's wonderful in its own bizarre way because it's sadistic as hell. But it does this tricky thing. It makes you understand it. You don't want to understand it. But then there's a whole third act where you have this aggression that the guys in the second act had. And you have to see it to understand it. Look, it's playing it up for gore. We know that. Okay? But there is a story there. And it is a cool movie. I think it's crazy, cool, frightening. But again, that's America. You can get away with that. But, you know, God forbid a girl puts her ass in a guy's face in a scene, or just a pair of tits, all of a sudden everybody's in a fucking uproar. And it's so ridiculous. And in comics, don't you think in Daughters of the Dragon, I would have loved if they just said, you know what, it's going to be a dope book, so go a little crazy.
Sure.
And we have a scene with Rika Donna walking away with a full ass shot. Okay. And the funny thing is, you got to understand the conversations we had over the ass shot. Is that going to stay in? Is that going to go like that? Are we going to put a word balloon over it? And I'm just like, look, the ass, the hole is covered. Okay? The winking spider, whatever you want to call it, is covered. Her ass is sticking out. We can watch TV if that's on TV. So, you know, and it's not, I don't think, you know, like I said, I don't know. I think kids are too sheltered. I think America is too worried about sex and not worried about violence. And I don't know how to even it out. I can only push my own envelope.
Sure.
I know what I like. I want R-rated horror films. I don't want PG horror films.
I
won't go to them because I know I'm not going to be scared. And it's not because of the violence. It's just I want to know that there's nothing in place that's going to censor what's going on. So automatically a PG for me means not scary or not mature because automatically there's something in place that says, this is not going to push the envelope.
Yeah, or the PG-13 TNA comedies are kind of the same thing. It's like, what are you doing?
And haven't they learned? Wedding Crashers was R, a good R
yep.
movie, and it made the most money. So why do we still have these crappy He Knows You're Alone movies coming out? All this crap, PG. It's the same stupid dumb blonde running around the house. You know, it's so goddamn boring. I can't tell you. You know, I get frustrated because I love film so much. And in comics, too, now, there's no, you know, what's considered risky is some writers doing the same goofy thing over and over, you know? And I don't know what to say to that. I mean, Vertigo, you got the key to the city to do anything.
Yes.
Are they doing anything? They're doing the same six or eight books, you know? I just wish somebody would push the envelope. I don't know who it's going to be, and it's not going to be me, but the pro was our thing saying, fuck it.
Sure.
You know what? This is... We paid for it ourselves. If nobody buys it, at least we're going to get a good giggle. And we got lucky with it.
That's cool.
It was total luck. It was the right book at the right time. Amanda's artwork was perfect for it.
Absolutely.
Was a girl drawing this. So we can be forgiven for every stupid joke we made in that book. Because a girl drew it. She drew a girl on a toilet breastfeeding with the panties down around the ankles. There's so many funny scenes. There's hand job scenes in the background. There's so many funny little things. But because Amanda drew it, it could be forgiven.
Sure.
You know, and that's society. And, you know, I'm sort of friends of Lulu. Probably pissed off, but I can't.
I do want to, down the line, talk to Amanda, and hopefully I can arrange an interview
as well. Yeah, same house. She'll do it with you.
Because I was wondering, too, with her JSA classified that wrapped up. Her Power Girl stuff.
Yeah, people love tits.
And yeah, there were tit jokes galore, and they were funny, and it was great. And it was great seeing Jimmy Olsen and going, wow, this is the first guy. Maybe he's not going to look at my chest. Oh, never mind.
Right. Jeff did a great job on that book. And Amanda, like, took what Jeff did and took it to another level. And you know, it was your regular comic. It was your regular, you know, thing. But Power Girl, Amanda drew her respectfully. Amanda's like, it's big tits. But that's who she is, and why should she be embarrassed about it? And, you know, we're working on a book right now where, you know, I'm telling Amanda, smaller waist, bigger tits. You know, because I can say that to her. Okay?
I understand.
Said, you know what, Beautiful Killer and Painkiller Jane and all these books, I kept going for the A-cup crowd.
Sure.
You know, I kept saying she's got to be lean and mean and not Lady Breast or whatever her name is, Lady Death. And I don't want it to be that, but you know what? It depends on the character. You know, with Beautiful Killer, it was supposed to be an 18-year-old girl.
Sure.
I felt like she should be like a thin slice of paper. You know, she should just be able to slip in and out of things. But Power Girl was fun.
That's cool.
You know, and again, look how it sold.
Oh, I mean, no, absolutely, man.
Like, holy shit. You know, we didn't know that. Third printings on third issues? What the hell is that? What is it telling you, though?
Well, and you're right, I think, and it acknowledge where the audience is. And yes, it isn't an all-ages book, that's fine. Everything doesn't have to be all ages.
Right. Absolutely.
So it's that simple.
Yeah, it sounds simple.
Right. No, and I understand that, and, you know, from the publisher's standpoint, too. You're right, I understand. What can you tell us about Bloodhaven without me asking any questions?
Well, you know, it's an aftermath-type book, so it's after everything going on.
Right, and we, you know, Crisis 4 obviously came out, so we know that Bloodhaven was blown up.
Yes, and we're dealing with the fact that it's a disaster area, and there's things in it that people want, and there's a whole bunch of characters that are going to be vying for positions in this, as well as the government. So the government feels they have their place in there, and they're supposed to be in there. The heroes feel they have a responsibility, and then we have the millions of people who are living in this disaster area. And it's sort of like the Mexican standoff for six issues.
Okay.
Okay, it's a million different characters, and every issue we're learning more and more what's in it. It you know what? It's really tough to talk about because every issue gives you something.
I get you.
We do get to throw some fun characters in there as well that we talked about earlier without me actually saying it.
Sure.
And we, you know, I'm inking Dan Jurgens on it. Dan's doing a beautiful job on it, and I never inked Dan, so
that's
writing
cool.
A book and then inking it, all of a sudden my personal interest gets, like, times 30, you know,
sure.
that it's got to look good. But it's definitely, it's one of those books that you need to pick up based on the fact that what happens in these six issues leads into the other books and other places, and actually into another book that Justin and I are doing. You know, when they came to us with it, it was a massive thing to do because we had to read everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to know everything that's going on in 52 and everything that's going on when, you know, with the 1 year later stuff. And it's a book that, you know, it's probably the biggest, most overwhelming thing we've worked on. And I guess in a way it's our shot at doing a bigger, it's like giving like the two schmucks something that might sell more than 30,000.
This is your big event book.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's, look, they're not my characters,
right.
You know?
Right.
But we're trying to give them as much, when you have a cast of thousands, you know, the only thing you worry about is everyone going to be heard and is it going to be fun? So what we're aiming for on the six issues is fun. Fun first, we flesh out personalities real quick You know, it's sort of like, and I do learn from Spielberg, in the first 5 minutes, we like that guy. You know, when we watch Jaws, we like that sheriff.
You bet.
And we're trying to do as much of that kind of storytelling where what they're saying is defining who they are. There's a lot going on. Like I said, a lot of characters you haven't seen, a lot of characters you haven't seen in a while, and then a lot of newer characters. And, you know, it's just, it's chaos. We're on issue 4 right now.
Okay.
Out of the 6. And every issue is a cliffhanger. Every issue is something going on. I kind of, you know, personally, I wish it was 10 issues because, you know, just the people in the city are interesting to me. You know, 9/11, being in New York during 9/11, there's a certain story I want to tell there that, unfortunately, I don't know how much I can tell in this book, you know, but we'll try our best to get some of the feelings of that kind of stuff going on, of just being hopeless, you know, helpless in a bigger picture of things. But it's a lot of fun. But like I said, you're right. It's our big shot. It's our big shot, and hopefully somebody buys it. Otherwise, we look like complete morons. If it doesn't sell, they will definitely never give us another thing, ever. You know, we'll have to run over to Marvel and try to get one shot. Like, you know,
when does it start?
It starts in May.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think February I got the Punisher book coming out that we did.
Yeah.
It's a Valentine's Day story.
Yes, and yeah, I did read about that. That's cool.
It's romantic.
Which is shocking.
It you know what it is? It's Paul Gillace, because we knew we had Paul.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Yes, please.
So so what we did is we wrote Paul a James Bond movie with Punisher in it.
Oh, that's great. So, and he's been there before with McGregor on that great Dark Horse book that he did.
Yes.
Paul, so...
That was awesome.
Well, and also actually Clive Reston back in Shang-Chi was, you know...
Dude, well, that, you know, look, that's my inspiration for everything.
Paul is...
Master Kung Fu.
Oh, that's
you know,
cool.
I love them so much. I cried after Paul left the book. It was just so much fun. And what we did is we put Punisher in a mission in Sicily with another girl spy sort of thing. And they have to get in tuxedos and infiltrate a casino in Rome.
Oh, that's great.
They got the bad guys.
That's really cool.
And they have a couple of moments where they have to pass the time with each other. And we just did our James Bond adventure because we had Paul. And I think it's Paul's best work he's done in years.
That's really great.
And, you know, Garth will probably hate it, you know, because it's not the bloodthirsty guy
right.
so much. It's more like, but what I did is we set up the fact that Frank lost his family and the other character lost a part of her family. And these two characters had their own personal pain. And this story deals with Suspiria as the character. It deals with her family. And Frank gets pulled into it. And he can totally relate to her because... obviously what happened to him. So it's kind of an, you know, I think it's a fun story. You know, like I said, he does get laid in it.
How many pages is that book?
It's 34.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely gets laid. She definitely sits there. There's a great scene where they're in a private jet and they're both undressing to go to sleep. And he's like, you know, is there anywhere for me to sleep? Like, because she's on the bed already in her lingerie. And she's like, stop acting like a second grader. And get over here. I don't know if they changed. I think they might have changed, but it's like that kind of thing where she's just saying, just get over here and do me, you know. It's kind of a fun scene, and like I said, the book looks beautiful.
That's great. You know, I think, and Marvel, I think, in these one-shot Punishers, along with the regular series, Garth is doing a great job. It's a beautiful book, and I'm a huge fan of that book, and he has great artists on it as well. But I really think Andy Diggle did a good job on his story. I liked your story a year ago as well, your Christmas story.
Text?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it's the same character. It's a Suspiria character.
Okay.
He's just all scarred up. You know, think that movie Crash and you'll understand.
I got you.
Yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, I enjoyed doing that, but I got to say the book suffered because Mark half read the script, so we had to rework the book a little bit.
Oh, okay.
But this book, you know, Paul's a better, nothing against Tex, but Paul's a better storyteller than him.
Okay.
You know,
Well, Paul's amazing. Yeah,
what's that?
I said, yeah, Paul's amazing. I know you guys have worked together on Catwoman as well.
Yeah, Paul, you know, Paul, I've been a fan of his since I was a kid, and he's not much older than me. That's the creepy thing. I mean, he's, I think he's like 47.
Wow, that's amazing, because, yeah, you go back to the, wasn't it the 70s when he was doing?
Yeah, he was like 16.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the guy is, he's the guy you talk to.
Oh no. he's on my list.
He is so fascinating.
No, I agree, and yeah, the people that he's worked with as well.
Yeah.
No, that's really cool, man. I noticed you mentioned that you've been doing computer work on the Punisher game with Garth.
Yeah, we wrote the Punisher game, which is out, And we're working on the Ghost Rider one now for the movie.
Oh, that's cool.
That comes out, the, what's his name?
Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, Nick Cage movie. That probably comes out in a year or two, but we did our part there. We wrote the story, the basic story and dialogue for the video game. And the Punisher game was our way of saying, well, the movie wasn't what it could have been, so play the game.
A lot of people, I think, were kind of disappointed by the movie.
Yeah, and you know what? I got to tell you, I like Tom Jane. Thomas is great, but the story wasn't there.
Well, it wasn't the Punisher.
No, it was some Tampa.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect example. You're right. The quintessential New York Avenger is in Florida.
Yes. It didn't make any sense, and they're working on a second one, I hear.
Yes.
So I'm hoping that fixes up. But Tom, yeah, I became friends with Thomas Jane. I mean, he did this dialogue for the video game, and he's a great guy. I mean, he understands it. He gets it. He was the guy saying, why don't you just adapt the comic? Just go in there and do Welcome Back, Frank, with Maganucci and the bear and the zoo and everything. And so we're hoping the second one they kind of look at, you know, either Welcome Back, Frank, or some of the other stuff we did and take it. But the video game, we went right to what we felt it should have been. The video game is violent and insane, but it's a lot of fun.
How would you characterize the difference in terms of writing for a computer game versus writing a film treatment versus writing a comic book?
The video game, you have a committee you work with. So even though we're writing it, it has to go before a committee. It's a ton more work. It's you know, we had to write 500 lines of dialogue for the video game. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it really is. And you have to break things down into chapters, and then what you have to do is you describe every action or and every alternative. Well, what if they go here and what if they go there?
Sure.
It's a lot of work. It pays well. It's prestigious for a couple of weeks, you know.
Yes.
All of a sudden, you're doing interviews in all these magazines that they never give a shit about you unless you killed the president or something. And then it's back to work, you know. I compare them. There's so much freedom in writing comics that I understand why film and TV guys want to do it, even for the shitty pay that it is.
Just because it's the freedom to really get your ideas on paper. There's no filters.
Write it, and then a month later, there it is. You know, I've done it with a pro. I'm doing it with like three books this year. Well, I'm just putting my own money. I'm having guys draw stories that I wrote, and I'll put it out. If it bombs, it bombs. I don't care. As long as I make my money back, or if I don't, then I write it off.
I
get to tell a story. You know, I got a couple, like Trigger Girl I'm doing with Phil Noto. Mm-hmm. I'm paying Phil out of my pocket for it. So we'll put it out. If it breaks even, it's a party. Meaning if I make back all the money I gave Phil for it, it's a goddamn party. If I don't, at least there's a property that's out there that we own, and the book exists, and hopefully I can sell it overseas, because they tend to like Phil's stuff in Europe.
I can see that.
You know, Beautiful Killer, New West, translated into every language, you know?
That's
so,
great.
So, you know, you hope for the best. Sometimes you lose. We did a thing called Cloudburst that totally bombed, you know? Cost me a fortune. But what am I going to spend money on? I mean, yeah, we pay the rent and, you know, we go through life and everything, but you got to experiment a little bit. You lose. So what? You lose. I tried it. I lost. Okay, I'll try it again. You know what I mean? There's a thing, you work within what you're given with. I don't believe in, I love comics so much, I'll put out my own crap. That's the way I feel about it.
How did Painkiller Jane do for you on the Sci-Fi Channel?
It was, I went up to the set for a week. It was a lot of fun meeting everybody, hanging out with everybody, drinking, going out drinking with them and partying. And the movie itself is nothing like the comic.
Okay.
Except for the name and the attitude of Jane, you know. But everybody did a good job in it. I just thought that, once again, guys that feel that they can do the character better than we represented it didn't. It got 2.2 million viewers.
Wow, that's great.
Aired. Yes, huge. It did really well. But Sci-Fi doesn't like it.
Oh, that's too bad.
Sci-Fi pretty much just, they show it. They'll show it again, you know. It'll wind up on, you know, some Sunday afternoon kind of, you know, I don't know. You know what they do. They run the stuff again and again. But I don't think they were crazy about it. The ratings were good for it. It was the, you know, other than the, they ran one of the Lord of the Rings films that night for the first time. But it was the second highest thing on cable.
That's terrific.
Yeah, so it had an audience. Sci-Fi doesn't, you know, didn't believe in it beyond the audience, and that's okay. That's their prerogative, you know. But they did a job on the film. It's not bad. I've seen 100 times worse on that channel.
Me too.
Jane was okay. And Emmanuel did a great job. Emmanuel and Tate and Richard Roundtree were awesome in it. And, I look at it as like, okay, there's that.
Yeah, you met Shaft. There's nothing wrong with that.
Dude, I met Shaft in the elevator. And I hung out in Emmanuel's trailer. And I went out with Tate drinking. And that was fun.
That's cool.
And, I sat with the director. And, they put me in limousines from the set to the hotel and treated me like hot shit for a week. and that's great. I mean, I got a producer credit and a creative credit. I'm on to the next thing. I'm working on two other films that in the next 2 years that you'll see, and you build up credits. It's sort of like the comics.
That's what I was wondering, if you guys are able to, you and Joe, are able to take something like that and build on it.
Yeah, you do, because automatically now, even if it's the worst thing ever, which it wasn't, it's still I produce something.
Sure.
Okay, and then another property of mine, whether it's Monolith or whether it's New West or Beautiful Killer or even Just a Pilgrim, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Just
a Pilgrim. I forgot about that, yes.
Yeah, something I edited. And these things come up and the studio picks it up. They right away look at whose name is on it. And they see me, and they look up, they do that Google search, and I'm all of a sudden I'm on that site that says I produced the film. They're like, oh, well, let's talk to him. He's obviously done this. And it's already happened. I wrote a couple of films for Nike, on LeBron James and Vince Carter. I did these short films.
Yes, on their website, yes.
Yeah, and these things lead to other things. So I'm hoping, because Justin and I have two screenplays we're currently showing around. I was going to say throwing around, and that's probably more accurate.
Okay.
And look, we don't know. If somebody reads it, that's at least, whether they're the assistant to the assistant, you try. You throw it out there, you pitch it. But the credits do help, because the next thing that gets made has my name on it as well, And then all of a sudden somebody's looking at my name and they say, oh, well, he did this, this, and this. And really, that's what people do. They look at what you've done. And in comics, you stick my name out there. Well, yeah, I've done a lot with Marvel Knights, with Event Comics. There's a lot of stuff. So I have the comic, I have the comic background, I think, pretty good. It's a pretty good resume. And films and the video games, all those things tie together. I guess the apocalyptic thing would be creating something and directing it and writing it. And I don't know if that'll ever happen, but my attitude is the best part of the trip is the trip,
Sure.
It's getting the opportunities and seeing if you can do things. I'm a firm believer in bullshit your way through it. if you think you want to do it, then get in there and try to do it. If you can't, then just bullshit your way through it.
I think there's some good substance behind your bullshit. So
well, thanks, I appreciate it.
And really, I'm digging Jonah Hex. I'm really enjoying Daughters of the Dragon. I look forward to Bloodhaven, and we'll definitely keep our eyes out on the horizon for more stuff from you, Ben.
Well, thanks, dude.
That's Jimmy Palmiotti. You can keep track of all the doings of Jimmy, Justin Gray, and Amanda Connor at their website, paperfilms.com. And that'll do it for this edition of wordballoon.com. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to wordballoon.com for more updates on upcoming episodes. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2006.